Thank you, everyone, for coming on. It's so nice to see all of you week after week. Of course, we usually do experience, people come in and out, and, not everyone's able to make it every week because life is so busy, but we really appreciate all of you prioritizing it and being here. Actually, just the energy of many spiritual people coming together, really trying to explore and discover and discern spiritual truth. Really adds to the atmosphere and helps us bring out a lot of jewels. And I have to say, today I am really excited. In the last two sessions, we've kind of been, I guess, just touching the surface, talking about general stuff, about, the need to disrupt our lives, the opportunity to go on the hero's journey, and taking that venture into the unknown of spirituality. But today we're really going to get into some of the substance of the Bhagavad Gita. Right here is the Bhagavad Gita. You can see there's different versions of it, but this is like, this is a serious book. This is a 1,000 pages, 700 verses, as all of you know. And what we're going to try and do is we're going to actually try and cover the whole landscape of the Bhagavad Gita in about 45 minutes. So there's going to be a lot of information. Have a notebook ready with you if you can, and take notes. And you remember, this will be recorded, so you can always re-watch it. But I hope, sometimes it's nice just to go right through the Bhagavad Gita in one go, because then you understand how ingenious a conversation it is. So that's basically what we're going to do today. So fasten your seat belts. Give us a wave and a thumbs up if you're enthused and inspired. Thank you so much. Let's really get into it and explore some of this beautiful wisdom. And as we do every single week, we'll begin with our gratitude prayer. So please do join in. I hope some of more of you have learned it now, so that we can open our hearts and minds to absorbing this beautiful wisdom. Om Agyanatimirandhasya Gyananjanashalakaya Chakshurunmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Om Agyanatimirandhasya Gyananjanashalakaya Chakshurunmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Om Agyanatimirandhasya Gyananjanashalakaya Chakshurunmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. I offer respect unto my spiritual teachers, who have opened my eyes, which were blinded by the darkness of ignorance, with the torchlight of knowledge. Thank you so much, everyone, again for coming, those of you that have just joined. In the first week, we discussed progressive disruption, how sometimes disruption is required to become more conscious, more aware, and therefore the spiritual disruptors come in over time to really prod us to think more deeply about life. Last week, we started delving into a bit of the introduction of the Bhagavad Gita, looking at Arjuna, the listener, his life, his challenges. We looked at the questions that Arjuna asks in the Bhagavad Gita and ultimately his transformation. We concluded that Arjuna is not just a historical character from thousands of years ago, but deep within us sits the inner Arjuna, and the journey that Arjuna goes through is the journey that each one of us can and hopefully will go on, right to the conclusion of perfection. And so, with that foundation, we begin to realize how the Bhagavad Gita is not just a story or a conversation between Krishna and Arjuna, but is a conversation between the soul and the Supreme Soul. And so today, what I'm going to try to do is take you on a guided tour of the Bhagavad Gita. all 18 chapters, all 700 verses, and I'm going to try to share with you the main things that Krishna teaches Arjuna along the way. And hopefully you'll begin to see why we're here spending so much time looking at this conversation. I want to begin by sharing with you that the Bhagavad Gita is actually a conversation which takes place in terms of two dialogues. The first dialogue, we can say, is the outer dialogue, which is between the king Dhritarashtra and his minister Sanjaya. Dhritarashtra is a blind king. His sons, the sons known as the Kauravas, have gone to the battlefield to fight with the righteous warriors known as the Pandavas. But he's a blind king. Therefore, he's not able to go to the battlefield. Therefore, he's back in the palace. And he's with his minister, Sanjaya. Now, Sanjaya has a kind of mystic potency whereby he can see things at a distance. In the modern world today, they call this remote viewing. The potency or the power that someone has by their mental accomplishment to be able to perceive things at a distance that are far away. And so Sanjaya and Dhritarashtra, although not on the battlefield, are also in one sense there because they're discussing all the events. And the inner dialogue is the dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna. Arjuna, as we know from last week, goes to the middle of the battlefield and begins asking Krishna a series of questions. And so the Bhagavad Gita is essentially the conversation between them. Now, right here is an incredible, incredible, incredible lesson. As I said, the Bhagavad Gita is two dialogues. There's an outer dialogue and there's an inner dialogue. Now, the outer dialogue is the dialogue where Dhritarashtra asks Sanjaya a very, very specific question. And what's the question that Dhritarashtra asks his minister? He says, "My sons, the sons of the Pandavas, all these warriors are based on the battlefield. Who are those warriors? And what did they do?" In other words, Dhritarashtra asks about people and he asks about events. And then Sanjaya begins to narrate all the different things that are going on. And then his conclusion to Dhritarashtra right at the end of the Bhagavad Gita is that your sons are going to lose. In other words, the people, your sons, the eventful, the fateful conclusion will be that they lose. That is the outer dialogue of the Bhagavad Gita. But the inner dialogue of the Bhagavad Gita is between Krishna and Arjuna. And what's their dialogue about? Wisdom. Because what's the first question that Arjuna asks Krishna? What is my purpose? What is my meaning? What is my duty? Why am I in this world? In other words, their dialogue is all based around wisdom. The first thing I want to share with everyone on the call today is something many of you have heard me say before. Small minds discuss people. Average minds discuss events. But great minds discuss wisdom. How much of discussions in the world are based around people and events? How much of it is gossip? How much of it is sensationalism? How much of it is hearsay? How much of it is just passing time? Ask yourself, how many of the conversations and the substance of what we talk about, how many of those things are really relevant to my life? How many of my discussions and the conversations I have really have a bearing on my future? How many of the things I discuss do I actually have any control or influence over? And how many of the things do I discuss which I actually know consist of accurate and clear information? If you look at so much of what people discuss, the newspapers, the media, social media, it's so much about people and events. But remember, great minds discuss wisdom. And then what they do is they see people and they see events through wisdom. When we focus on the outer dialogue, then we focus on the things we have no control over. But when we focus on the inner dialogue, then we focus on that which we can control and that which we can influence. And therefore, when we're beginning the Bhagavad Gita, we're looking at these two dialogues, and therefore we're very much focusing on the conversation between Krishna and Arjuna, because that's where all the wisdom takes place. And so here we have it, the Bhagavad Gita. This is the wisdom that Krishna shares with Arjuna. Here for our course, our recommended reading is the Bhagavad Gita as it is, the widest and biggest selling copy of the Bhagavad Gita in the world, translated in over 80 languages by Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. And I'll just show you a few amazing things. Bhaktivedanta Swami has done an incredible job, because what he's done is, the first thing is he's given us the original Sanskrit. Sanskrit, the actual word for Sanskrit is Devanagari. It literally means the language of the gods. In Sanskrit, you don't say things, you sing things. It's a beautiful language, not just a beautiful language. It's a language which has incredible detail. For example, in English, we have one word, love. But in Sanskrit, did you know that there's nearly 100 words for love, depending on the intensity of love, depending on the flavor of the love, depending on the relationship of the love. In English, we have one word, water, but in Sanskrit, you have 70 words. So it's an incredibly detailed language. Not just that, Sanskrit is an incredibly clear language. It's even said that NASA scientists, they draw from Sanskrit for their computer languages, because they say it's the most unambiguous language in the world. And not just that, Sanskrit is said to be incredibly dense. So sometimes when you have one Sanskrit word, you will need 5 or 10 English words to translate it, because there's so much meaning in one word. And therefore, this language, Sanskrit, is an amazing language. But what you'll realize is that many of us are a bit rusty on the Sanskrit. So here we have something called in Sanskrit, Ucharana. And Ucharana means a transliteration. And what Bhaktivedanta Swami has done is he's taken the Sanskrit script and he's Romanized it. So basically, we can read it in the English alphabet, even if we don't know Sanskrit. So all of you can begin speaking Sanskrit. It's incredible. Sanjaya uvacha evamuktva rishikesham gudakesha parantapa nayotsya iti govindam uktva tushnim babuvaha. There, all of you can recite Ucharana. And Sanskrit, just by hearing it, even if you don't understand the meaning, it has an incredibly powerful effect on the consciousness. The next thing that Bhaktivedanta Swami has done, he's given something called a Padda Cheda. And a Padda Cheda basically means a word division. So he's broken up the verse into different word divisions. And how you break up those word divisions is very, very important. And what he's given along with it is something called a padar tokti, which means a word for word. So if you want to increase your Sanskrit vocabulary, if you want to cross-reference verses by learning specific words, then you can do that in this version. And then what he's given here is something called a Vakya Yojan, which means a translation. And then what he's done, very, very importantly, is he's given something called a Tika. Nothing to do with tandoori restaurants. A Tika means a commentary. It means a purport, a description, an application what Bhaktivedanta Swami has done is he's taken the insights of great teachers over the ages, and also through his own vision of the practical reality that we're living in now, he's basically given a description of how to live, apply, and translate that knowledge into our life today. So this is really a labor of love. It's such a beautiful version of the Bhagavad Gita. And this will be our text. And this is basically what we're going to summarize today. So fasten your seatbelts. The Bhagavad Gita is 5,000 years old. It's 700 verses long. It's split up into 18 chapters, covering five major topics and taking us through three main yoga paths with one goal, which is to make us think very, very deeply about life and begin to question and scrutinize and critically look at the way we're living and how we could live in a better way. You see, there's two ways in which we change our life. One is because of inspiration. And if that doesn't work, then we change our life because of frustration. When we read a book like the Bhagavad Gita, we are basically getting the opportunity to change our life through inspiration. Krishna offers all these inspirational insights, and we have the opportunity then to look at our life and say, this is how I can upgrade, elevate, and empower myself. But if we don't take advantage of wisdom and we don't learn how to live in the way, in the most natural and spiritual way, then what will happen is we'll face frustration. And when we're frustrated in life, we'll have no choice but to then go back to the drawing board and say, something needs to change here. So I don't need to do a survey here. I'm sure most of us would prefer to avoid frustration and rather cash in on the inspiration. And therefore, if you want a new idea, read an old book. Because what I'm going to try to share with you today is that everything that everyone in every sphere of life, in every culture of the world is seeking is found within the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita can be looked at in many, many different ways, but today I am going to share one way of looking at the Bhagavad Gita with you. And it's basically going to take this scheme. If you look here, what I'm circling here on the top, then the Bhagavad Gita has 18 chapters. So you can see here, these are the 18 chapters I'm circling here. And what I'm going to show you, or try to show you, with the blessings of my teachers, is that there are eight main things, or these are eight main lessons you can draw from the Bhagavad Gita. And these are perhaps the eight things which people are incredibly concerned about in the world today, right? Just in case you're wondering whether the Bhagavad Gita is a relevant book, I'm going to show you how there are eight main things that Krishna teaches, amongst many other things, on this journey of the Gita. And this is the top thing on everyone's mind in the here and now. Now, we're going to open up the chat, and I'm just going to ask you a question. In the world we're living in today, people are definitely concerned about self-development, about becoming the best version of themselves. Can you tell me some of the books which you feel are really, really important books, or really, really popular books, or books that you've benefited from that you think people in the world today are reading in order to achieve their full potential? Ash comes right in and says, The Secret. Herschel says, Start With Why, Think Like a Monk, Atomic Habits, thank you so much. The Prophet, Khalil Gibran, thank you. Ikigai, yes, Finding Your Purpose. The Four Agreements, The Alchemist. Yeah, just everyone can take a look at the chat and look at these books. If you go into Waterstones today, which is one of my favorite things to do, and you look on the shelves, these are the books you'll find. Jordan Peterson, huge. Code of the Extraordinary Mind, yes. The Smiling Monk, thank you so much, Trishul. Yeah. These are books that people are reading. It's amazing. Here I'll show you some of the biggest selling books of our time. These are the books that you'll find on people's shelves. The Secret, Rhonda Byrne, she went through, she had an Arjun moment. She had a call to adventure. And Rhonda Byrne underwent a transformation and she discovered what she calls the secret, the law of attraction, how we vibrate at a certain energy and we attract what we vibrate. And therefore, consciousness creates reality. Interesting concept. Robin Sharma, the monk who sold his Ferrari, someone who went through life, a lawyer who later on realized, yeah, maybe I've achieved all these things, but maybe I need to disconnect and explore the inner world. So he went to the Himalayas and kind of hung out with the sages and the yogis. James Clear, here's another New York Times bestseller, how to make tiny changes in your life to experience remarkable results, how to change your habits. Habits are such a big thing. You know, we struggle with habits. They say in habits, even if you take the H away, still a bit remains. Even if you take A away, still bit remains. And even if you take the B away, still it remains. Yeah, sorry, I know that was a bit cheesy, but I couldn't resist. Habits, big thing. What about Covey? This is a legendary book, yeah? 7 Habits of Highly Successful, Highly Effective People. This was really, Covey gave a whole new approach to time management. He said it's not just about doing and fitting everything in. There's a time matrix, there's urgent and there's important. And you have to wisely choose how you navigate your journey in this life. And here we go, Eckhart Tolle, The Power of Now. Everyone so much is trying to live in the now. These are some of the books you're going to find on someone's shelf today. But remember the quote I gave you just a few minutes ago? If you want a new idea, go to an old book. And let me now show you some of the things that Krishna teaches Arjun on the journey of the Bhagavad Gita. One of the first things Krishna teaches to Arjun is redefining success. We really see this in the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Jim Carrey, he said, I think everybody should get as rich and famous and do everything they ever dreamed of so they can see that it's not the answer. And what does Arjun say? I can find no means to drive away this grief, which is drying up my senses. I will not be able to dispel it even if I win a prosperous kingdom, sovereignty, and the demigods, a life of the demigods in heaven. In other words, Arjun comes to that moment where he realizes everything I thought was success is not success because it hasn't made me happy. The Bhagavad Gita explains life is structured in such a way to basically teach us what success is not. Life is structured in such a way so that every time we achieve something which we deem to be success, we very quickly realize that success never brought us happiness. We make our goals, we make our aspirations, we make our journey in life, and then later on, we realize even if we meet those goals, there's still a vacuum in the heart. And we've already talked about this in the last 2 sessions. And this is the conclusion that Arjun comes to right at the beginning of the Gita, that I have to redefine success. Because when I look for success in material things, a few things may happen. Futility. When we look for happiness in material things, For example, a material relationship, futility. You don't get the husband, you don't get the wife you're dreaming of, you don't find that person of your dreams, frustration. But the other problem with material happiness is that even if you do end up getting what you're looking for, insubstantiality. It doesn't make you happy. It's not as good as you thought it would be. It's almost like an anticlimax. You get it, and then you think, now I need something else. This hasn't fully quenched my thirst. And that's the next problem with material happiness. But the third problem with material happiness is if you manage to get it and the experience is very, very good, the next problem is temporality. It doesn't last. It fades. It becomes hackneyed and it disappears. And what once stimulated you no longer stimulates you in the same way or is no longer present. And therefore, everything fades. And even if you don't experience any of those things, the next problem with material gratification is that there's duality. There's always something which comes along with it. Back in the day, we used to listen to tapes and there was a song that you really, really wanted. But on the B side, there was another song that you really hated, but you couldn't just take side A. Side B comes with it. And that's the nature of life. And therefore, if one is very, very thoughtful and they look at every single material aspiration that they aim for in this life, thinking it would make me happy, they'll realize that either it ended up in futility, or it was insubstantial, or it was temporary, or it came with a bunch of other things that caused you discomfort. And therefore, naturally, for the person who deeply faces this inconvenient reality, they begin looking towards spirituality. And that's what Arjuna did. And that's what all of you are doing. That's why all of us are here. If we were happy in the material world, if everything was good and we were completely satisfied with everything we've achieved, we wouldn't be on this call. Why would you? Because you're successful. But we're all here because we're realizing I have to redefine success. The next thing that happens in the Bhagavad Gita is that Krishna says, yes, you have to redefine success. Material happiness won't cut it. And therefore, he says to Arjuna, you have to look for a different type of happiness, spiritual happiness. But what is spiritual happiness? Before we can understand what is spiritual happiness, we have to know who we are. Now, this is such a big thing in the world today. Ralph Waldo Emerson, he said, to be yourself in a world that is constantly trying to change you is the greatest accomplishment. Most of us in this world suffer from incredible inauthenticity. We have a vision of ourselves that's so removed from reality. One person, he says, I'm not who I think I am. I'm not who you think I am. I'm who I think you think I am. In other words, our conception of ourselves is a perception of an illusion. That's how removed from our identity we've become. They say for most people in the world, there's only two times when they're authentic. Before the age of 5 and after the age of 75. Because before the age of 5, you're too innocent to kind of put on a facade. And after the age of 75, you don't have any more energy to put on a facade. You're just real. But in between, we put on so many masks. We adopt so much superficiality. We present ourselves and recreate ourselves in certain ways which aren't authentic and don't feel like they're authentic. And so Krishna gets to the root of it. And Krishna says, those who are seers of the truth have concluded that of the non-existent, the material body, there is no endurance. And of the eternal, the soul, there is no change. There is no happiness in life until we deeply connect with our authentic self. In Sanskrit, there are two words which are very, very important. One is upadhi, which literally means a designation. And the other word is anartha, which means impurity. What's basically happened is that Krishna says to Arjuna, you've accepted one lie, and from that lie, these two lies have come about. The root lie, Arjuna, that you've accepted is that you are this body and you are this mind. But what Krishna goes on to tell Arjuna is that you're not this body, you're not this mind, you're a spiritual being, a spark of consciousness, a metaphysical entity beyond the limitations of this material substance, and you're animating this body. But because you've begun to identify with this body and this mind, you've developed upadhis, designations. I am American, I am a lawyer, I am rich, I am good at this, I'm the top of this, I'm better than everyone else at this. And we define ourselves in many, many different ways, designations. And the other thing that we've picked up is impurities, lust, anger, greed, envy, all these qualities. And Krishna, what he's saying is you have an identity which is separate from this and separate from this. And as you learn to purify this, then what happens? You realize you're a soul, you're a spiritual being. And when you connect with that deeper identity and realize of the soul, there's no change, but of the material, it's always changing. You see, our abilities change. Our facilities change. Our identities change. And every time these things change, we face an ego death. We face a sense of, who am I? What am I? Where am I going? Am I even worth it? Because we identify with the wrong things. But Krishna says, you're not any of those things. You're a spiritual being. And therefore, rediscover your real identity. Can you see the incredible journey that Krishna is taking Arjuna on? This is so simple, but it's so deep. The next thing Krishna starts teaching Arjuna about is how to reposition his lifestyle. Arjuna has accepted that there's a spiritual goal. He's a spiritual being. He's on a spiritual journey. But Arjuna's looking at Krishna and he's like, but I'm living in this world and I have things to do. And I have duties and I have to make an effort and I've got demands and responsibilities. How do I integrate it all? Gandhi, he said, a burning passion coupled with absolute detachment is the key to all success. And so what Krishna teaches Arjuna is something called karma yoga. In other words, spiritual acts which are conducted in the world with a higher goal of connection in mind. And what does Krishna say to Arjuna? Therefore, without being attached to the fruits of activities, one should act as a matter of duty, for by working without attachment, one attains the supreme. So what Krishna basically says to Arjuna, let me try and explain it to you. Krishna says, there's a material side to your life. For example, Arjuna was a husband. Arjuna was a warrior. Arjuna was a king. Arjuna was a father. These were all the roles that he was playing. Now, on the spiritual side, Krishna said to Arjuna, you're a soul. And you're on a spiritual journey beyond this life. So Arjuna's natural question is, how does this integrate? And what Krishna says is it does integrate, because what you have to learn to do is be a spiritual husband. What you have to learn to do is be a spiritual warrior. What you have to learn to do is be a spiritual king, or in Sanskrit, what we call a Raja Rishi. And what you have to do as a soul is be a spiritual father. In other words, there's a way you can integrate your life. What we tend to do is compartmentalize everything. My spirituality is what I do between 5 and 7 on a Sunday. And my material life is what I have to do the rest of the week to survive in this world. No, there's a way in which you can reposition your lifestyle to bring everything together. And what Krishna says is that you have to do your duty and you have to put in effort in this world. But at the same time, you have to be detached, because you have to know that you're not of this world. You're on a bigger journey. And so Krishna says you can factor in both a burning passion coupled by an absolute detachment, right? That's what you do. And so Krishna says, act in this world, have the right intention, give the right attention, and perform the right action. And once you've done all of that, then be detached and understand that you are successful, whatever the result, whatever the outcome, whatever may come of your activities in this world. And so do you see how Krishna is teaching Arjuna how to reposition his lifestyle so everything becomes a part of his spirituality? Everything is connected. Arjuna looks at Krishna and he's like, okay, you told me to redefine success. You told me about who I really am and that I'm on a spiritual journey. You taught me about how to connect everything I'm doing in life to that spiritual journey. It all makes sense, but Krishna, I've got this mind. And that is not easy, because to control this mind and to stay focused on everything you've told me to do, I don't know if I can do that. Eckhart Tolle says, all problems are illusions of the mind. They say the mind creates reality, because everything starts in the mind, but the mind also translates reality. And therefore, this constant thing is going on. We're creating reality through our thoughts, and then later on, when it's created, we're translating it through our thoughts. And therefore, if we've not learned to control the mind, it will be our greatest enemy. And what does Krishna say to Arjuna? For him who has conquered the mind is the best of friends. But for one who has failed to do so, his mind will remain the greatest enemy. So Krishna begins to share with Arjuna how to conquer his mind. Krishna basically tells Arjuna, it's possible, but it's not easy. I want you to think of your mind like a browser. This is your Google. It could be Mozilla, it could be Edge, it could be Firefox, it could be Internet Explorer, whatever it is. Think of your mind as a browser. Every browser has a home page. Every browser has its favorites. Every browser has a history. And every browser has an autocomplete. Krishna, what he says to Arjuna is, just like you can optimize a browser, you can change the home page, you can adjust the favorites, you can delete the history, and you can revisit other websites which will change the autocomplete. In the same way, Krishna says, by abhyas or practice, you can reconfigure the browser of your own mind. Because our mind is configured in a certain way, it always has default thoughts it goes back to. Because our mind is configured in a certain way, when we see something, immediately all these other thoughts come up. Because our mind is configured in a certain way, because of what we've experienced in life, we have this history which seems to imprison us within this mind. But Krishna says, by abhyas, you can reconfigure it. But Krishna says, the other thing about a browser is that no matter how many times you change all of these things, there's always the chance that there'll be pop-ups. And therefore, Krishna says, the other thing you have to do with the mind is vairagya, which means detach yourself from the mind. Don't identify with the mind. Identify the mind. And therefore, you don't have to take seriously and act upon every single thought that comes in your mind. Learn to watch your own mind. And in this way, Krishna trains Arjuna on how to remold his mind. Isn't this amazing? This is golden knowledge. And mental health is the biggest challenge in the world today. I'm speeding through because time is going. And there's so much to talk about here. As the narration of the Gita continues, Arjuna is looking at Krishna and says, controlling the mind? I get it. I understand it. I see now how it's possible. But really, in our hearts of hearts, we don't want to just control the mind. We want our mind to be enchanted, captured, absorbed, immersed, attracted by something. In our hearts of hearts, we don't just seek peace and clarity of thought, but we seek to find affection, love, and deep connection. And so in these middle six chapters of the Bhagavad Gita, beginning from chapter number 7, Krishna begins to explain bhakti. And this is the goal of the Gita. The first six chapters are about how to live. The second six chapters are about how to love. And the final six chapters are about how to let go. But here, we're now talking about how to love. Oprah Winfrey says, the chance to love and be loved exists no matter where you are. We're loving beings. We desire to give love. And we desire that love to be reciprocated so that we can give even more, so that we can reciprocate. And in this way, the goal of life is love. And therefore, Krishna in this chapter and this section begins talking about love. That love is not so much about behind the actions of love are the intentions of the heart. And it is those intentions that capture our imagination in relationships. And therefore, Krishna says, if one offers me with love and devotion a leaf, a flower, fruit, or water, I will accept it. And so in this section, although the thrust of what Krishna is talking about is the connection between the soul and God in a relationship of love, it also gives us an idea of how to experience love in all of our relationships of this world. Basically, when people think of love, there's physical love, or so-called physical love. There's emotional love. But then there is divine love or spiritual love. What differentiates physical love from emotional love from spiritual love? It all depends on, one, your vision of that person. Two, the goal of why you've come together. And three, the role that you're playing in each other's life. If you want to know how deep a relationship is, how spiritual your love is with another living being, even if you want to know how spiritual your connection of love is with God, just ask these things. What's my vision of that person? Do I see them as an order supplier, a gratifier? Do I go to them for things? Do I have expectations of them? Or do I see them as someone I can serve, someone I can offer something to? What is your goal? Why have you come together? Do you have some motivation? Is it to cover up some insecurity? Or is it to genuinely help each other to grow towards some kind of higher, more beautiful life in the future? And what is the role? Are you actually uplifting, being positive, being encouraging in that relationship? Or are you draining energy? Are you being condescending? Are you discouraging? Then you'll basically be able to understand how much love there is in a relationship. And so Krishna begins giving all these keys of how to awaken a higher quality of love, which is basically what everyone seeks. And then as the narration goes on, Krishna reveals more and more that all the love of this world can only really flourish if we first and foremost connect with the supreme love, the supreme person. Imagine if you have a tree. You can think of a tree, and a tree has its roots. And if somehow we water that root and we pour that water on the root, then what happens is that the whole tree becomes nourished. The whole tree becomes energized. All our relationships flourish when we're reconnected with the Supreme. God is like oxygen. You can't see Him, but you can't also live without Him. Today in the world, people have different conceptions of God. They sometimes think of God as a judge, a controller. Sometimes they relate to God as a cosmic order supplier. Sometimes they think God is just a concept to prop up the weak who can't deal with life. But the Bhagavad Gita paints a very different picture of God. Krishna means all attractive. God is full of charm. God is full of character. God is full of charisma. And God is very, very close. Sometimes people think God is far, but Krishna is not a far God. Krishna is very near, and there's a possibility to connect. And when you make that connection, this is what is called yoga, to connect. And so Krishna says, know that all opulent, beautiful, and glorious creations spring from but a spark of my splendor. To encounter the divine is not something we have to wait for till the end of this life, but to encounter the divine is possible even in this world, as long as we've uplifted and upgraded our vision to perceive divinity everywhere. And so divine presence and divine connection and relationship is possible, because what Krishna is basically saying is that the divine is alive, but not just that the divine is alive, the divine is also attentive. But not just that, the divine is affectionate, but more exciting than even that, the divine is active. One has the opportunity to connect and experience and communicate and reciprocate with the divine in the here and now. And that is what Krishna talks about. And then, remember the final six chapters. The first were about how to live. The middle six were about how to love. And the final six were all about how to let go. So Krishna now to Arjuna, he gives him the last bits of information which help him to navigate his journey through this world and learn how to operate in the atmosphere of the material world and still maintain a very, very high level of consciousness. And so he says to Arjuna, learn to reconfigure your energy. And how does he do that? By talking about something called the three modes of nature. Successful people are simply those with successful habits. They say your thoughts lead to your actions. Repeated actions turn into habits. Repeated habits turn into your character, and your character determines your destiny. And so habits are at the very heart of everything. They are defining our life journey. And so what Krishna says to Arjuna is that there is the mode of goodness, one of the qualities of nature, which conditions one to happiness. There is the mode of passion, which conditions one to greed and intense endeavor, attachment. And then there is ignorance, which covers and debilitates someone and degenerates them and basically creates illusion and darkness in their life. Now, the most amazing thing is when you learn this framework, the three modes of nature are basically inside us and they're also outside us. According to the mode of nature inside of us, we'll create a certain environment outside of us. And according to the environment we associate with and the energy we associate with, it will create a certain energy and disposition within us. So the three modes of nature are an incredible framework because everything is in one of these three qualities. The food you eat can be in goodness, passion, or ignorance. The way you parent your children can be in goodness, passion, or ignorance. The way you study for your exams can be in goodness, passion, or ignorance. The environment and the state of your bedroom can be in goodness, passion, or ignorance. Even the way you drive your car can be in goodness, passion, or ignorance. And we won't ask for any confessions. But this is the amazing thing. And Krishna says that if you learn to reconfigure your energy and live in the mode of goodness, or what we call sattva, then what will happen is that you'll experience overall a greater feeling of happiness and joy in your life. Why? Because from sattva, your relationships will improve, your health will improve, whether physical or mental, your character will improve, and your overall sense of achievement will improve because you'll be more focused, more determined, more perseverant. And so Krishna gives this amazing framework of how there are all these energies in the world. And Krishna says, right now, you're inclined in a certain way. You understand the word inclination? It means like, for example, a road has a certain inclination. So right now, if you were to have a bucket of water here, and you were to pour water down here, because we have an inclination, the water would always go in a certain direction. So right now, many of us are inclined in the wrong way because we haven't reconfigured our energy, and therefore negative and bad habits come very, very naturally to us. But when we learn to reconfigure our energy, then what will happen is our habits will naturally flow towards the positive and the good, and will begin to flow with a positive energy in this world that helps us to achieve everything we want to achieve. And finally, in the 18th chapter of the Gita, Arjuna, equipped with all this knowledge, says to Krishna, I'm ready to re-enter the world and become a servant. The essence of life is to serve. Rabindranath Tagore, he said, I slept and I dreamt that life was joy. I awoke and saw that life was service. I acted and behold, service was joy. And so Arjuna looks at Krishna and he says, my illusion is gone. I've regained all my memory by your mercy. And I'm now firm and free from doubt and I'm prepared to act according to your instructions. So what Arjun says is, now, Krishna, you've taught me to redefine success. Now I know what success is. Not just that, Krishna, you taught me who I really am, beyond all these artificial identities, that I'm a spiritual being on a spiritual journey. But then you went further, Krishna. You taught me how to reposition my lifestyle and live in the world as a spirit soul. And you taught me that even though it's difficult because you have a mind, you can remold the mind and you can make the mind your best friend on this journey. Krishna, you went further. You told me how I can reawaken love, how there's physical, emotional, but ultimately spiritual, divine love. And you showed me how I can connect with you and feel your presence at every moment. And then you came back and you gave me further knowledge on how to navigate the world with all of its different influences. And because you've done these seven things, I'm ready to re-enter life, but with a different perspective, so that I can serve, I can make a contribution, I can bring happiness to the world, happiness to others. And in bringing happiness to others, I can experience the greatest joy within myself. And this, dear friends, is the journey of the Bhagavad Gita. And now can you see how everything we're reading about in the world, whether it be The Secret, the monk who sold his Ferrari, Atomic Habits, Habits of Highly Effective People, Living in the Now, how it's all based on ultimately the same knowledge that's been passed over the centuries. But if you really want to develop yourself, it must go hand in hand with spiritual development. Self-development without spiritual development will stagnate. It won't be deep, it won't be sustainable, and it won't get to the core root problems that we face. But when we approach self-development and spiritual development hand in hand, then we create transformation, and not just transformation, we create a life in which we begin to fulfill our heart's desires. I'm just looking at the time. What's the time? 9 o'clock. There's so much more to say, but I'm going to have to just give me 2 minutes to say the final things. In the material world, the way of learning is linear. In other words, if this is information, then you just learn more and more information. But what happens is, as you learn more and more information, it becomes more and more superficial. This is perhaps the story of our life, that we just taught to become repositories of information, to memorize more things and pass more exams. But the actual deep depth of that knowledge is basically lacking. But in spiritual spheres, we learn that to actually grasp the knowledge, it's not about more and more and more, but it's more like a spiral in which eventually we just hone in on the essence. I've had the fortune to read the Bhagavad Gita for nearly 3 decades now, and I feel like this is just such a profound insight, that as we circle the same knowledge of a book like the Bhagavad Gita, but what we do is we read it repeatedly. Not just that, but we read it broadly by looking at all the different insights that the ancient teachers and even contemporary teachers have given us into the Bhagavad Gita. And we bring all of this knowledge back to the Gita. It enriches our understanding. And not just that, when we read it discursively, in other words, in forums where we can ask questions and so on and so forth. And not just that, when we read it practically by experimenting with the knowledge of the Gita, Krishna says, remold your mind. Okay, let's give that a go tomorrow and let's see what happens. Then when you do this, although seemingly you're reading the same thing, what's happening is the knowledge is going deeper and deeper and deeper until the point where you realize the truth is actually very, very simple. So simple that you may just miss it. And this is the beauty, and this is the last thing I'll share with you. Spirituality is less about denial of the self. It's more about discovery of the self. Spiritual life is less about isolation. It's more about integration with society, integrating your roles, responsibilities. It's less about leaving relationships, and it's more about redefining relationships. Not just dealing with people on a physical or emotional level, but really connecting with people on a spiritual level. It's less about information. We're not just trying to get more information here, but what we're trying to do is experience real transformation. Spirituality is less about renunciation and more about becoming dedicated to a beautiful cause, a contribution that you can make to other people's lives and the world. And it's less about holding back and more about giving back. And so this, dear friends, is the message of the Bhagavad Gita. And this, today, we've gone on a super quick tour. The amazing thing is that Krishna taught the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna in 45 minutes. I think we went a little bit over that. But I've tried to give you the gist of what Krishna shares with Arjuna. And you may want to rewatch this. That was a lot of information I just gave, but I hope it was somewhat useful and gives you a little bit of an insight into the amazing wealth of knowledge that is there in the Bhagavad Gita. And remember, it's a spiral. You just keep going back to it. Yeah, this you just keep going back to it again and again and again. And it has so much to offer. Thank you for tolerating me. That was a long speech. I don't like speaking so long, actually. But I just felt as though I wanted to share that with you, because in the last two sessions, we went quite general. And so I thought today, let me try and get a little bit into it. So, yeah, Raj, over to you. If we have maybe 10 minutes of some interaction and maybe some individuals have some questions they may want to ask, then I'm very much open to trying my best to respond.
Thank you so much, Keshav Swami. That was absolutely amazing, and so many great comments coming in. Maybe you don't like speaking so much for so long, but we love you speaking so much for so long. So thank you so much. Right, I'll dive into the questions because we've got some really nice ones to come up. And thank you all for sharing them. I think it's been a very active chat today. And some great questions have come in. So the first one is from Shreya, Shreya Kalaria. And she's asked, how do you differentiate whether the thought is coming from the mind or it's coming from the super soul?
Oh, amazing. Such a nice question. So just to bring everyone on the page, we understand that the divine is also sitting within our own hearts. And therefore, there are almost two birds sitting on the tree of the heart. One bird is the individual soul, us, and the other bird is divinity sitting with us, also known as the super soul. And what modern gurus kind of talk about in terms of intuition, from the perspective of the Bhagavad Gita, we would say that's the super soul or divinity kind of inspiring you from within. The question is, how do we know whether something is coming from our mind, or how do we know whether it's an intuition, a divinity within us? Therefore, the first thing we do is we have a checking system. So whenever something comes within our mind or our heart, whether it's the mind or intuition, we do always do two things. We look at that inspiration or that thought through the lens of the Bhagavad Gita. And so we kind of analyze that thought. So if there's something within you which kind of says like, yeah, I really think I should eat like 3 Mars bars tomorrow. Then you kind of look at the Bhagavad Gita and you think, Mother goodness, that's probably more the mind than intuition. So a lot of philosophy can help us to sift through what is actually a divine indication and what is just our mind. So wisdom helps us to differentiate what is a genuine inspiration based on spiritual source. And the second thing that helps us is we always have spiritual people who we can check with. So say, for example, you got a more difficult one, like say, for example, you get an inspiration in your heart that I need to, I've got a calling to do this career because I think this is my contribution in the world. Then you can always have spiritual people around you who can help you to understand whether that's just a temporary kind of figment of your mind or whether that's something more deeper that will actually help you on your journey. So whenever we're trying to ascertain the voices within us, we take help from external sources to kind of look at them more objectively. Hope that helps.
Thank you. And I hope that helps, Shreya, your question, and very nice question for asking. The next question is from Rajiv. It's a great name. So can you explain what our soul is? Is it energy? Is it light? Is it God? Is it alive? Is it attentive? What does the Gita say about the soul?
Yeah, if you read the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, then Krishna gives a whole kind of description of the soul and what the soul is. But essentially, the soul is 3 qualities. In Sanskrit, we say Sat, Chit, and Ananda. The soul is basically comprised of these 3 things. Sat means it's eternal, it's non-physical, it's existing forever. It's like can never be destroyed. It can never be harmed. It can never be invaded by the material nature. So the first thing is Sat. It's eternal. The second thing is it's Chit. It's cognizant. It's conscious. It's aware. It has knowledge. And when it's in its pure state, it has pure awareness. And the third thing is Ananda, which means bliss. It's full of joy, it's full of happiness, it seeks relationship, it seeks to exchange, to give love and receive love. And so the soul is basically the spark of consciousness, it's who we are. It's not that we are a body and we have a soul, we are a soul and we have a body. If you look at every fairy tale, then every fairy tale ends with the words, they lived happily ever after. And if you think about that line, it basically points to the soul, because lived means to be conscious, or the quality of chit. Ever after means to be eternal, which is the quality of sat. And happily is the third quality of the soul, ananda, which is to be full of joy. So even when fairy tales end, they lived happily ever after. What they're basically doing is talking about the 3 qualities of the soul that Krishna mentions in the Gita, which is that it's an eternal spark of consciousness, which is fully aware and which seeks to exchange love through divine relationship.
Thank you so much. A brilliant, brilliant answer. We've got a few more questions come up, and I think we're going to have to take some of your questions on the on our next session or on our live. But I'll ask a few more, if that's okay. So we've got one from Alex Murray. So if the mind creates problems, how do we deal with physical health problems? Like, is it just acceptance, or do we have positive thinking? What's the solution to the mind in that sense?
Yeah, the first thing I want to share is that even modern science says this, that a lot of our physical health problems begin on the subtle level. So when someone has stress, when someone's suffering from anxiety, loneliness. They say loneliness is more damaging to your health than smoking 30 cigarettes a day. And so the problems that we face on a physical level often have their root in the subtle level. And so therefore, Krishna says, I mentioned about how to remold the mind. Number one, by spiritual practice. And number two, by learning to detach yourself and watch and become an observer of your mind instead of constantly identifying with it. So that's how we deal with mental health. And physical health, we understand ultimately everyone's physical health will decline. That's just a fact of nature. So when our physical health is declining, the idea is that even that physical health decline is an impetus for us to begin to identify more and more with our spiritual self and become more and more detached from the physical self. You see, the idea is your beauty will disappear. So don't think that you're valuable in this world because of your beauty. Over time, your abilities, your memory, your intellect will begin to disappear. So don't think you're valuable because of your intellect or your abilities. Over time, your positions of power and everything will be taken away. You'll have to retire at 65. Therefore, don't identify with those things. And so a lot of the reason why physical health problems cause such a anxiety within people is because they've identified on the physical level so much of their life. That's been their identity, who they are. But when we learn that, no, I'm a spirit soul and I'm just inhabiting this body and playing, you know, Shakespeare says, all the world's a stage and each person in his time plays many, many roles. So I'm just playing a role. And off stage, I'm a spiritual being. And when we learn to identify on that level, then even the mental and health challenges, we're able to detach ourselves from it a little bit more. Hope that helps. Easier said than done. It's a practice.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. And very, very important points there. I guess the last or second to last question, maybe the last one, is from Valentina. Mm-hmm. So shout out Valentina, I can see you. Valentina has asked, where does the Gita stand in terms of the Vedas and Upanishads in terms of timing?
Yeah, so, well, the Vedic knowledge, we understand it to be existent from the time of creation. So that's hundreds and thousands and millions of years ago. But the timeline is that basically 5,000 years ago, all of that Vedic knowledge, which previously was passed down through oral reception, it was spoken by a guru, heard by the student, completely assimilated and memorized by the student, who then eventually become a guru and then speak it to his students. And in that way, knowledge was passed down. But 5,000 years ago, the great sage called Vyasadeva foresaw that people's memory would decline, that there would be a good chance of knowledge and wisdom being tampered with. And so what he did is he compiled all the Vedic literature. And it was around that same period that Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna 5,000 years ago. So we can say the knowledge of the Vedas has been existing since the time of creation. The Bhagavad Gita was spoken 5,000 years ago and is considered the essence of all that Vedic knowledge. But in essence, we can also say that the Bhagavad Gita was existing within the Vedas, the same knowledge, but maybe not in the form of that conversation. That conversation took place 5,000 years ago and is contained within the Mahabharata, which is one of the histories of the Vedas, the history of ancient India. And maybe in future talks, we'll kind of show you a diagram of all the Vedic knowledge, and therefore you'll be able to see where everything fits in. Hope that helps.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. And thank you for asking that question, Valentina. So thank you so much, Keshav Swami. I think we'll leave it there. And there's some great
questions.
Yes,
there's so many more questions, but we'll have more time in the future.
Yeah, I think maybe in the next session, because there's some really good questions have come in from Dipali and from Bhavna and Deepak and Venu. Some great questions have come in. So yeah, we definitely have to. Shall we move on to our announcement?
Yes, we have an announcement for everyone. So here we are, we're all online, and I hope you're getting something out of the wisdom, and it's helping, and it gives you some food for thought and inspires you to go away and explore the Bhagavad Gita. So yeah, we started this community online, and the idea of doing it online was that we'd be able to have a reach and we'd connect with people far and wide and bring loads of different diverse minds together. And I think we've achieved that, and we want to do more and more of that. But as you know, we don't exist in the virtual world. We're real people, and we like to have real exchange and meet each other in real life as well. And so what we thought we'd do is invite all of you to come together and be together for a day where we can all spend some time kind of reflecting on some of these teachings, doing some exciting spiritual things, and just having a really uplifting experience where we can all, just share our own spirituality with each other. And so you can see here on the screen, Raj has brought it up. We are going to have our first ever Think Gita retreat. So you can give us a round of applause or a thumbs up or loves or whatever you want to do for that. It's going to be on Saturday, the 4th of February. So that's two Saturdays from this Saturday coming. So just in just over 2 weeks. We're going to have a whole full day. This is where I've had the fortune to live for quite some years now. So we'll all be there, and we'll have a day of like meditation. We'll do chanting. We'll take you guys over to our farm. You'll meet the cows. You'll walk around the lake. We got a beautiful nature walk. And we're just going to do lots of practical things and just give you a living experience of spirituality. So it's Saturday, the 4th of Feb. It's from 10 to 5. We just really want everyone to come along. And some of you may already have been to the manor, but even if you've been, you can still come along and experience more of it. Come over for the company. If some of you are outside of London, just take a day out and drive down. It's a beautiful time to come. So that's what we're doing, Raj. Do you want to add anything more?
Yeah, thank you so much. And I can't wait. It's going to be very exciting. It's going to be a great day. So maybe I'll just answer some of the questions that have come in. So yes, you can bring your whole family. You can bring your friends, maybe people who haven't been to the manor before, or if it's your first time, bring people with you. We want to connect with everyone. It's going to be a very great day. We're going to have Keshav Swami. We're going to have meditation. We're going to have mantra music. It's going to be amazing, and I'm really looking forward to connecting with everyone on a personal level, because I guess the timing is just perfect, because at the end of our course, and what a great way to end the course than to meet in person. You can register online. The link is on the chat. Maybe we'll just post the link again. So the link's on the chat, and we'll be sharing the link, and you can forward it to your friends and family as well to join. It's there's a registration fee, so if you go at the end of Eventbrite, it's £10, and it'd be great. It'd be food. It'd be great to see everybody.
No, I was just saying, and I'm also looking out at the participants and realizing there are also a lot of our community members who are not in the UK, and Think Gita is not a UK. We're all about world domination. So we're all over the world. And what we're going to do for those who are outside the UK is that in future, as Think Gita expands, then hopefully we want to have retreats all over the world in different places. And so we'll be connecting with you to create those in-person experiences wherever you may be. On the call, I see people from France, America, India, of course. So many places, South Africa. So hopefully we can do that in the future. And maybe you could, we'll zoom you in for the day so you can join some of the sessions as well. So you'll be with us in spirit. So yeah, please, everyone come down. Like, we really want you to be there. We really want to see you. Well, God, I'm sounding like George Harrison now. It is George Harrison's house, by the way. And I think you'll just have a great time and really build a relationship. So yeah, Pritesh is going to be there. Wonderful.
Yeah, I think if you're coming, just put a yes on the chat. It'd be nice.
Yeah, put a yes if you're coming, just to see like if some of you are actually going to come. Because otherwise, it would just be like me and Raj. Okay, Emily's coming. Wonderful, excellent. Chintu's going to come. Ajay's going to come. Priya's going to come. Wonderful. Yeah, so many of you are going to come.
Somebody coming from Caroline's coming from Belgium. Brilliant.
Oh wow, yeah, you can get in. You know, I just took a Eurostar from Belgium. It doesn't take so long. You can come in. It will be wonderful. So yeah, we got a lot of good energy here. So please do try and come. Even if you can't come for the whole thing, you can come for half a day. One other announcement is, some of you may know Radhika Das. He's one of our legends, our good friends. He's an amazing mantra chanter, and he's agreed to be with us for a day. So he's going to lead an incredible meditation sound experience. So yeah, you'll love it, you know. And we're going to have more discussion and stuff. So yeah, it'll be life changing. Yes, Pritesh. Yes, he's a legend for sure. So thank you everyone for hanging on. I know we've gone a little bit over today. The notes and the recording, as always, will be available on the Think Gita community. And give us some energy on the community. Post your comments. We're trying to really make it a live experience. Very, very soon, we're going to break up the big sessions and start creating smaller groups where we can interact together and go a little deeper. So watch out for that. Follow us on Insta if you aren't already following us. And just thank you for being part of it. It's wonderful.